Hey, listeners, welcome back to the Busby Babe podcast. I'm Colin, joined once again by Polly and Nathan. How's it going, guys?
As swell as can be, Colin. Swell as can be.
Oh, we are slowly just ticking away as we move closer and closer to insanity.
Polly slowly becoming Matthew McConaughey from True Detective.
Probably.
I can't wait to see the ponytail and mustache and crushing beer cans.
True Detective, right. Slash that one scene in Interstellar where he's going crazy trying to figure out how to reach Murph.
Murph!
As my hair just grows and grows and grows, unlike footballers, because they have money, they still have access to just cut all their hair off.
Yeah, that seems to be the trend now. I think Eden Hazard did it most recently, but Pogba and Martial bald now. You know, the quarantine boredom has really set in, but the three of us always record remotely, so nothing's really changed in terms of the production of this podcast.
Right, it has not gotten any better.
Yeah, considering several thousand miles separate all of us, I think we were ready for this situation.
Oh, yeah,
but also, we're recording in the afternoon today, so we're not drinking yet. Or we're not drinking while we record, so maybe the production has gotten.
Polly, are you saying that you were drunk the last time we recorded a podcast?
I'm not saying I was drunk. I was saying that I was having my first two drinks of the day.
I would like to shout out Polly for thinking that I don't have something else in my coffee right now. So thank you for thinking better of me.
Well, anytime.
All right, so we got some Manchester United news to talk about for a little bit, and then we are going to do another review of a season review. Of the 2007-2008 campaign, which, you know, of recent memory seasons is definitely top of the list. Although, does it even qualify as recent memory anymore that was 12 years ago?
I was a junior in high school, so I'm going to say no.
Yes. No, this is one of those weird ones. You know how, like, when people say, like I guess the meme was going around, like, 10 years ago? When people were like, oh, if you asked me when 1980 was, I'd still say it was 20 years ago, and I'd still probably be like, 1980, that's 20 years ago. Yeah, like this 2018 was still like 5 years ago to me. And the amount of times that I've watched content from this season, it's still a fresh memory.
Yeah, that's probably one of the most vivid memories that I have was that season, because that was probably the first season where almost every weekend I woke up to watch a game. Before that...
Yes.
Yeah, I was in eighth grade in this season, so like fifth, sixth, seventh grade, I was like kind of into it. Like they were my favorite team or whatever, but this was the season that like drew me in and made me a huge fan of this team.
This was the season where I discovered illegal streaming. So when they weren't on TV, which was pretty often, but when they weren't on TV, which happened, I was still able to watch the game, albeit with no DVR, so it was like, hey, 7:45 this week, got to get up and find this stream and watch it in a little 4-inch box on my screen and keep Xing out all the pop-ups. But it was the first season that I really watched every single game because I could. So just because of that, I was still in high school, so it wasn't the following season. I was in college, so while I did the same thing, I was much more hungover and tired and tended to drift off and nap during the games sometimes. So this is like the season where I very much remember every single game.
Well, and it makes sense that, you know, this might have been the season that Colin really gravitated towards things and got up extra early on Saturday mornings to watch it, since we determined last podcast that he didn't watch Power Rangers. So
right.
It's not like he had anything else to watch on Saturday mornings anyway. It was perfectly slotted in.
Yes, it's very true. Although I did watch... there was one Power Rangers movie. It was on VHS that was from the 90s. I don't.
That one was so terrible.
That did narrow it down.
It was like
the 90s.
It was like the white Power Ranger was the main villain.
Yeah,
or something.
That movie was so bad.
Yeah.
That was with Ivan Ooze, right?
Yeah.
All right, we've lost our listeners right there.
So maybe that was my start at Power Rangers, and that's why I've both forgotten that I had seen that movie and didn't watch Power Rangers at all as a kid. So,
what's pathetic is I didn't find out till college that like this was just Japanese, like it was all Japanese things that they just refilmed the like scenes where the people weren't being the Power Rangers. You just dubbed over Japanese action. I had no idea about that.
Well, that's what happens when everybody wears helmets and it's animatronic bad guys.
Subs over dubs. All right. So, Manchester United news, getting right into it. Odion Ighalo has been offered a new contract by Shanghai Shenhua in an attempt to keep him at the club past his loan spell at Manchester United. It seems like they're a bit worried that he will want to stay even at a reduced cost just because, you know, one, it's his dream club, but also this is his probably his last shot at playing top football again. I mean, he's playing at Manchester United, you know, coming off the bench most likely in bigger games, but this is still Premier League football.
Yeah, so if I'm Shanghai Shenhua, I'm actually probably pretty nervous about the reception that Odion Ighalo's gotten ever since he's gotten to Manchester United. I mean, it was his dream club that he wanted to play for, and everybody's, you know, received him really, really positively since he's arrived. You know, our Slack channel is really excited whenever he gets in there and he plays. You see all the different groups on Twitter, like Full Time Devils, you know, the Nigerian R9, everybody's calling him. Like, the reception that he's gotten has been so positive. I could just see him saying, hey, I'm a little bit older. I've made, you know, pretty good money here in China. Now it's time to play for keeps for the team that I really want to play for. And now that we're seeing some rumors that he might even become a permanent buy for Manchester United, I'm sure Shanghai Shenhua is going to offer whatever they can to try and keep him.
Yeah, my question is why? I mean, they are a team that lacks goals, as I'm looking at what they did last year, but he scored 10 goals last year for them in 17 appearances. Four of them were PKs, so he scored 6 goals from open play. You want to put this guy onto $400,000 a week? Like, you're that desperate to keep him? He wasn't even their leading scorer last year. And I guess the issue is that they'd have to replace him, and China isn't exactly the most desirable location anymore, and that's before this coronavirus thing. You know, in the last couple of years, we haven't seen as many players making the jump, you know, the way that Oscar and Ighalo and Hulk, to name a few, have gone there. Gareth Bale did try, or they did try to get Gareth Bale there last year. Fellaini did go there, but I guess it's not as much the payday that it once was. And I think that has something to do with their tax laws regarding transfer fees. So in this case, Ighalo already belongs to them. They wouldn't have to pay a transfer fee. So that would save them a lot of money. But I would think if you're saying, hey, United would have to pay $15 million to sign Ighalo permanently, I feel like take the money and try to find a different replacement. Then it just becomes a should United be paying $15 million to sign Odion Ighalo question.
Right. And, I mean, this has kind of flipped it around where in January when talks about signing Odion Ighalo permanently, not just on a loan deal, were kind of being floated, being sort of, you know, a waste of Manchester United's money. And now, you know, he's delivered a little bit. He's still on enormous wages, obviously. But I don't know. It just seems like it kind of flips the onus onto Shanghai when they really didn't need to do this.
Right. To me, it's still, when I wrote about Harry Kane this past week, because that got floated out into the stratosphere last week, thank God it's died down. I had a part in there that our lovely editor took out because I was going on a bit of a tangent of being, you know, should we sign Ighalo? Ighalo, in theory, is the perfect third striker, the perfect backup striker that we need. You know, he doesn't need to play every game. He's fine to come off the bench. He's going to eat up minutes in the cups, and he's doing a great job of not just eating up minutes in the cups, but scoring goals in those cups. You could still start Mason Greenwood over him whenever you want. But and when he did sign, you know, we looked at Henrik Larsson. That was the comparison that everybody got. Hey, last time we signed a striker on loan in January was Henrik Larsson. He scored. He had an immense effect on the club, is the narrative and the storyline. In all reality, he scored 3 goals. He happened to score 3 big goals, but he scored 3 goals. And I was like, if Ighalo can come in here and score 3 goals for us, I think I was referring to in the league, but, you know, I'd be happy with that. He's now scored, what, 4 in 3 starts?
Mm-hmm.
All outside of the league. So he's had great chances in the league. He had that great chance against Chelsea. He had the great chance against Everton where Pickford made a great save. He had a great chance against Watford where he rounded the keeper. He hasn't scored on those. That happens, so it's not like he's been invisible in the Premier League. But I would like to see him score in the Premier League before we give him a permanent contract. I think right now it's a little bit too overreactionary to say 4 goals and 3 starts, this guy's delivering, when your goals have come against the likes of Bruges and Derby County and who's the other one again? And LASK. Fantastic goal against LASK, but let's not pretend this isn't a step down in quality to what you're facing in the Premier League. And in a normal situation where we were on an international break right now and we were about to start the run-in and have the Euros and go next year, if he's not scoring in the Premier League and we actually qualify for the Champions League, then is he the right fit for this team? If we didn't qualify for the Champions League and we have to play in the Europa League again next year, clearly you give him a contract because he can eat those minutes so that Martial and Rashford don't have to. But if he's not proving to score at the higher level that you would need him to be, then I don't know if you give it to him.
Right, and that's why, I mean, every transfer is being thrown into this sort of situation, but there's so much uncertainty about what should be done now that the season is looking less and less likely to actually be finished. And I think that makes his loan more complicated, too, because there is such a small sample size of what we've seen from him and what he can contribute to Manchester United at a top level.
Yeah, and when I wrote about Odion Ighalo, the feature piece that I put out last month, that was kind of my thought process was, for the time being, just on the loan deal, I thought it was a smart move, even though people wanted to kill us for it, because they're like, how could a guy like Odion Ighalo go to a club like Manchester United? And at least for the most part, in that short little span, he's kind of proved United right taking the risk on him. But, you know, I had a bit in the piece where it was like, the whole reason why we're not freaking out, at least on our end in the Busby Babe, was because he wasn't signed to a permanent deal. You know, we would have melted the servers down writing features had he gotten signed to like some, you know, big money contract of like $20 or $30 million from, you know, Genoa, that we would have like lost our minds. So it's going to be an interesting situation, because we talked about it today in our Slack channel too, about, you know, there's going to be a decreased revenue that all the clubs are going to make depending on how the season finishes out. If the season even finishes out, there's going to be less money to spend on players this year because people aren't getting the same TV revenues from the contracts. So then you have to look at it like, you know, Ighalo was a great, you know, loanee for us, but is he worth the extra expenditure when we have our sights on a player like Jadon Sancho or Jack Grealish? Whereas maybe if we had a full transfer budget going into this next upcoming season, maybe he's like an extra little buy that we could have made, where now we'd have to really look hard and say, you know, thank you for your service, but we just can't afford to keep you on permanently.
Yeah. And, you know, speaking of more expensive players, the next bit of news, something that Polly has written passionately about, Manchester United linked with a move for Harry Kane, who is supposedly unhappy with Jose Mourinho's Tottenham Hotspurs and wants to move to a club where he will win trophies. Polly, you want to go ahead and take the lead on this one?
Yeah, first of all, I have trouble believing the actual news and rumors, because the author that wrote this article wrote literally the exact same article 367 days prior, if my math is correct. It was March 2nd. Last year, he wrote it on March 3rd this year, factor in there was a leap year, so there's an extra day in February, so it's 366, 367 days. Same article is, oh, if Spurs don't finish in the top 4 and they don't win any trophies, Kane's going to look for a move. And this year, the United people just kind of started latching onto it. It kind of came out it gave more life when the Buccaneers signed Tom Brady, and they're like, see, the Glazers are willing to go and get the biggest star. And just no. Like, it's a lot of money for a player who is often injured and who statistically is just his game is deteriorating and it's dropping off. He's still really, really good. He still has a lot of attributes that say, you know, that United can really use. But for $150 million or whatever the equivalent will be when we come out of this uncertainty, you're paying for a lot of what he's done and not enough of what he's going to do for you. And for that reason, you know, pass.
Yeah, it seems like an odd move for a lot of reasons. I mean, one, Manchester United and Dan Levy don't really go together. He's notoriously overpriced his players when Manchester United are interested. And another reason is that we don't really have a need at that position. Like, I'm not going to sit here and make the argument that Anthony Martial is a better striker than Harry Kane, but for the way that Ole Gunnar Solskjaer likes to play, and, you know, the amount of money that he would have to spend on just getting that one player, I don't think Harry Kane seems like a very good tactical fit for us either.
I think he can fit. He's very, like, because he's very good at dropping into the hole, and that's where his best years with Tottenham were. He dropped into the hole as, like, a number 10, sprayed the ball out wide to Eriksen. Dele Alli would run on past him, so imagine him dropping deep and Bruno or Pogba running right on past him, and then he'd make that late run into the box, and he'd, the width would come from whether it was Eriksen or Danny Rose or Kyle Walker or Kieran Trippier, and he was very good at smashing it in from the middle. So in that sense, he would be a good fit. It's all those other intangibles. If, like you said, is it a need? You know, I'm not going to sit here either and say that Anthony Martial is a better striker than Harry Kane. And the last thing you could do is say, oh, Igalo's going to go back to China and we're not going to bring in another striker for Martial, because the last thing you want is Martial to get complacent. Mm-hmm. The best thing that Odion Ighalo has done since arriving is Martial is scoring in every game now. So at least he feels like there's someone there actually pushing him, and that would be great. So if a striker like Timo Werner, who, you know, has his best days ahead of him, was available, absolutely go and get him. But for a striker that's just like, you might get, I compared him to when we signed Robin van Persie. And, you know, we signed Robin van Persie, who had 1 year left before his legs just went. And it was worth it because he single-handedly dragged us to a title that year. It was one of the most fun seasons I've ever watched. And then for 2 years, he was, you know, almost had to be put out to pasture. But we spent $24 million on that. You can't spend $150 million on he has one or two good years left in him before he's going to become the dead weight that we've worked so hard to clear out.
Yeah. If you almost wanted to liken it to NFL or something, Harry Kane, or even basketball, Harry Kane feels like the final piece buy that you make, but we're still definitely in a rebuild. You know, a lot of the manager said we're probably still three or four guys away from really having the kind of depth in the squad and the kind of talent in the squad that he thinks that can compete for championships. And I think that that's a luxury buy right now for Harry Kane, and especially with the injury history that you brought up, I just don't think it's worth it. At the end of the day, it's not worth the risk of spending more money than we spent on Pogba and then having another player, you know, sit in the stands for half of the season because he just has some kind of soft tissue injury. I guess the one person who'd really be pushing for this move would be possibly Gareth Southgate, because as we continue to vacuum up the British talent, we could almost become or set up England like Germany was set up with the Bayern Munich teams, where so many of the guys play together so much at club level that they can then transfer to the national team level.
As both an England and Manchester United fan, I would like to see that, but I'm just way more emotionally attached to Anthony Martial than Harry Kane, to be honest.
Who Kane just isn't that mobile, especially anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, Kane's got 70 pace in FIFA. Like, I can't deal with that.
Well, someone who does have good pace in FIFA, who we are also linked to, Jadon Sancho from Borussia Dortmund, surprise, surprise, rumored to be around £120 million. Seems like this story has been pretty much on repeat all year, since he signed a contract extension with Dortmund last summer, which almost certainly was aimed at, you know, making his exit from the club more expensive in the future, so that they could actually get something out of it. But do you guys actually think that he leaves Dortmund at this point, the way that things are going with, you know, the coronavirus, as well as Dortmund being a club challenging for the Bundesliga, as well as playing in the Champions League almost every year?
Well, that's two different questions now. No, I mean, the coronavirus makes everything just completely uncertain, but otherwise, yeah, 100% I believe he's looking to leave Dortmund. That's been spoken about in, you know, very reputable German papers who are usually very on top of transfers and very can listen to them. They're trustworthy. It's been that way all season long. It's basically been he's ready to move to England, and Dortmund are ready to sell him because Dortmund will never take the, you know, they understand value, and, you know, it's better to get rid of somebody a year too early than a year too late. And they understand, you know, what we can get for him now, $120 million is the number that's being talked about. Remember, they paid eight. So, yeah, they'll take an £112 million or euro profit on Jadon Sancho. And that's how they run their club. So they will not, and it's part of how they recruit. You know, that's how they landed Erling Haaland, is they said, we're going to give you the chance to play here, and we will not stand in your way when you want to leave. So, yeah, I think he's going to leave, and Dortmund's not going to stand in his way.
Yeah, I agree with Pauly on that one, especially just looking at how Dortmund handles their business. That'll be $300 million they've made off of wingers in 4 years, I believe, with the sale of Ousmane Dembele, Christian Pulisic, and then Jadon Sancho. I mean, that's an incredible haul, especially when you look at the amount of money that they spend on each of those players. Just from a business sense, the ROI is just too enticing not to take advantage of it. And I think the reason why I am starting to get overly excited about this transfer is because of how frequent and how steady the rumors continue to come out. It's not one of those like, oh, here's just another player that's linked with United. This is a player that's consistently linked with United for the last calendar year. And I think after all the work that they put in with Bruno to get him over the edge, I think there is an emphasis to start their business early now, especially when everybody's just sitting there twiddling their thumbs waiting for the season to potentially restart. I'm sure Solskjaer is putting a big push in for a guy like Sancho.
Yeah, and I brought this up the other day, was there's two things happening here. Because the only news, I mean, there's been maybe, like, for to keep the numbers easy, it feels like in the last week there's been about 100 transfer rumors coming out, and like 97 of them involve Manchester United. And it's like, are we at work here during this, while everybody's, you know, home isolating? Are we still at work? Is Woodward working the phones? Maybe we are, because maybe Solskjaer's like, well, I don't have to run training sessions every day, so I can, you know, focus on the recruitment side of my job right now. Or maybe this is just Neil Ashton churning out his Manchester United PR, and this is why he gets paid the big bucks by Woodward to make it look like we're doing something. But I will say, like we just said, I think Sancho's leaving, and all season long it's been who's going to get him. Liverpool were interested. Now they seem less interested. Chelsea, it really seems to be between United and Chelsea. He, you know, I think he's from, I'm not sure if he's from London or Manchester, but, you know, he's a City Academy graduate in a way.
He's from London. He grew up a Chelsea fan. So.
Oh, lovely. But anyway, you know, like the whole thing was, it seemed like United had this in the bag for a long time, and it was more of a matter of will they make the Champions League? And I guess last week or 2 weeks, or maybe last week, I threw it out on the Slack channel, like, hey, maybe there won't even be a Champions League next year. And that would give us a leg up on anybody else, because we won't have Champions League football, but nobody else will either. And I remember Nathan mocking me, but hey, look, that might be happening.
Yeah, does City's ban still count if there's no Champions League next year?
I would assume it's like the next, I don't know. There's so many things to work out.
And in that topic too, that there's been more articles that have come out stating that a lot of Premier League clubs are really pushing and trying to put pressure on the CAS to uphold that ban.
Yeah,
so
that was hilarious.
There is like a unified grouping trying to make sure that City is punished for the way that they've done their business. And also one last little bit about Jadon Sancho, because I was trying to answer your question for you, Paulie. I looked up where he's from. I'd like to wish Jadon Sancho a happy belated birthday. He turned 20 2 days ago. Wish your birthday was under better circumstances, Jaden, but hope to celebrate yours as a Red next year.
Nice. Good pitch.
Can I say?
I hope the number 7 shirt doesn't weigh him down too much.
Yeah, that hasn't fared too well for previous wearers. It really, since Ronaldo, I don't think we've had a good number 7. But, I mean, Michael Owen scored that one goal. That was pretty fun.
Right.
Can we give him Nani's old number?
Fred wears that.
Yeah.
Oh, you're right.
All right. So we're going to take a quick break, and then when we come back, we're going to talk about the 2007-2008 season, so stay tuned. And we are back. We are going to discuss the 2007-2008 season review, which I just want to say, from a cinematography and, you know, technical standpoint, much easier to watch than the 2010-2011 season review.
So much better. And John Champion, right at the beginning, I was like, oh, we got like a professional production.
Yeah. And no MUTV footage used at all, which was very nice on the ears. And, you know, nice on the eyes. Probably Manchester United's best season, maybe second best season of all time, you know, aside from the treble season. Premier League champions.
Oh, challenge. This was their best season. This was their best team. This was their best team.
Yeah. I would say that too.
Treble season's a better season. This was the best team.
Yeah.
But this was a treble season.
With the charity shield.
Stop with that. That is Jose Mourinho bringing the values and the trying to hype himself, because remember, that's what he's all about. And that was when everybody says, oh, our standards are lower when we accept mediocrity this year. No, our standards lowered right then and there when Mourinho claimed he won a treble by counting the Community Shield.
Yes, Community Shield champions as well. And I thought it was interesting, actually, the Community Shield game, because it kind of did foreshadow the rest of the season. I think John Champion may have actually said this when he was narrating, but, you know, the season would come down to, you know, the final day of the Premier League against Chelsea, where they actually drew at Stamford Bridge, so we didn't even need goal difference to beat them. And then a penalty shootout in the Champions League final, which, I mean, one of the more stressful games I've ever watched, but actually a game that I didn't get to watch the whole thing of either.
Well, that's probably why we won, because we seem to do well when you shut the TV off.
That's a big point right there. That's true.
It really was wild, and like I've written about it, not recently, probably a few years ago, when I did a post once about like the best teams that didn't win that people don't remember, and that was this Chelsea team. I mean, United were this was like I just said a minute ago, I think this was United's best team ever. Mm-hmm. And like you said, they got pushed to the final day by Chelsea. Like, this was never in the bag. Chelsea were right there with them the entire season and the second best team in Europe. Like, it's insane how good Chelsea were that year, too. And they managed to push what I think is the best United team right down to the wire. And, yeah, the Community Shield probably was the best way to – set up that season, because it was United and Chelsea and everything, and it's a shame that they didn't meet in the final of the FA Cup.
It really is, because the FA Cup that season did not live up to the rest of the competitions that season. Like, even the League Cup final, I remember being pretty exciting with Tottenham beating Chelsea. But the FA Cup, Manchester United, and we can get into this game now, because it was going to be a talking point anyway. I mean, Manchester United lose to Portsmouth in the quarterfinal. Chelsea lose to, I think it was West Brom in the quarterfinal. And the semifinal teams are three championship teams in Portsmouth. And Portsmouth ends up winning the FA Cup 1-0 against Cardiff City. And one of the more disappointing FA Cup. You know, like, it's nice when smaller teams can win a trophy. But it was so, so disappointing that that really should have been a treble run for us.
I'm surprised that, like, Tottenham hasn't tried to claim, like, half that FA Cup. Because that was when Redknapp was at Portsmouth and, like, basically just plucked all the players from Tottenham and then brought them back to Tottenham. Wasn't it, like, Defoe was on that team?
Peter Crouch.
Nico Crankshaw.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was basically, like, the way Tottenham... That trophy belongs as much to Tottenham as, like, the 1994 New York Rangers Stanley Cup, like, also belongs to the Edmonton Oilers. But it is, yeah, I share, yeah, the FA Cup, wasn't that the year that Barnsley went at, knocked two teams out, like, knocked out Liverpool and Chelsea, like, away both years or something?
Yeah, maybe it was Barnsley that knocked out Chelsea, because they got to the semifinal, too.
Yeah, it was Barnsley knocked out Chelsea, like, a week after they knocked out Liverpool. Yeah. And both of them were away. It was wild.
I think that was also the season that Havant and Waterlooville, which is a non-league team, got to maybe the fifth round, which was insane for a non-league team. And they played at Anfield and scored two goals.
Yeah, so it was a year where the FA Cup really opened up for United, and the treble was very much on the table. United beat Villa, then they beat Spurs, then they whooped Arsenal in what was just a ridiculous game at Old Trafford where it was a rotated squad. It's, like, weird to say that, but it was. Rooney played, but no Tevez, no Ronaldo, no Scholes, no Giggs. It was Fletcher and Anderson in the middle with Nani and Park on the wings. And who else was in there? But Rooney was up top, and Nani and Anderson just, I mean, for lack of a better word, they just took a giant jump all over Arsenal. They wiped the floor with them. And then you get Portsmouth when basically Chelsea and, like, all their rivals had been knocked out. And you get Portsmouth, who, I mean, you look at the team that day, Brown, Evra, Ferdinand, Vidic, that's your normal back four. Hargreaves, Scholes, Nani, Ronaldo, that's basically your normal midfield. Rooney and Tevez up front. And they pummeled them. They put Portsmouth under siege right from the get-go. And David James just stood on his head. A freak injury to Van der Sar caused a substitution at halftime for the goal. And just everything just that could have went wrong. And somehow Portsmouth escaped with a 1-0 win.
Yeah, Kuzcak got sent off, right, giving away the penalty that Portsmouth scored.
Right, I mean, yeah, which... I'm not going to sit there and be like, well, if Van der Sar got, you know, if we had a goalkeeper on the bench that we could have brought in to take the penalty, like, it would have been different. Like, they probably would have scored that penalty anyway.
Right.
But just a red card to your goalkeeper, and the fact that, so now you're going 10 men, but also just the fact that they took like 20 something shots that game, and David James stood on his head and kept it out. And somehow this team, which just scored for fun all season, loses 1-0 when the treble was, I mean, that in theory could have been the last time that Rooney and Ronaldo even played in the FA Cup. They could have rested them in every FA Cup game going forward and won the treble.
Right. Nathan, you okay?
Yeah, I thought I had my mic on mute. I had to switch rooms. My roommate was making quite a bit of noise.
Okay, yeah, there was just a lot of rustling.
I swear to God, I thought I hit the mute button, so sorry for the terrible audio, everybody.
That's good. I just wanted to make sure you weren't, like, choking or something. Like, we need to call Richmond 911 or whatever.
No, I'm still safe. We're good.
Right. So, yeah, miss out on a treble, but still... I mean, such a memorable season for Cristiano Ronaldo's individual performance really transcending to the, you know, all-time great status that he's been at for the last 10 years or so, scoring 42 goals in all competitions that season, and forming a quasi front three with Rooney and Tevez that, I mean, probably, you know, the reason that that is the greatest Manchester United side of all time, or that the argument can be made that they are, because Rooney and Tevez work so hard off the ball. Sir Alex Ferguson giving that front line so much freedom and interchangeability. Paul Scholes and Ryan Giggs still pretty near the top of their game, despite, you know, clearly aging. Michael Carrick.
Well, they never had, yeah. Right. I mean, it's the one thing that Ferguson's written in his book was, I didn't play Paul Scholes enough that season. Like, not strategy tactically wise, it was just, you know, as a person, as someone who's been at the club forever, as someone with the skill set that he still had, you know, was unfair to me what I did to him, basically. It was, I just didn't play him enough, and it's because, yeah, Carrick was so good that year, and Owen Hargreaves came on, and he was so good, and we got Anderson, who was, you know, really good, and I do remember down the stretch, you know, when you thought about it, I just, every week, one of my favorite parts about the season was Saturday morning, wake up to watch a game, and every week it was, who's going to play today? Because you genuinely didn't know. You had Ronaldo, Giggs, Nani, Park on the wings. So it could be, you knew it was probably going to be Ronaldo, and any one of the three could be on the other wing. And you knew it would probably be Carrick or Hargreaves, but you didn't know which one. And Anderson, Fletcher, Scholes as the other one. I think I hated Darren Fletcher back then simply because he wasn't as good as the other ones. And I was like, I don't want to watch you play. I want to watch the good ones play. It was who is it going to be? And it could be anybody. And that was part of the fun, but it came because every single player basically made themselves undroppable that year.
Yeah. It was just everything coming together, which it seemed like Manchester United have a really frustrating history in the Champions League anyway, for as good as they have been for so long that they've only won three is kind of remarkable, but everything coming together is what it took to finally get the Champions League. And defensively especially, this is a Manchester United team that stands apart from really any other. And I think maybe even the treble team, because the treble team, especially in the first half of that 98-99 season, was having a lot of trouble on defense. And Jaap Stam is considered one of the best center backs of the last few decades. But Rio Ferdinand and Nemanja Vidic have just a legendary partnership, and this season is a big reason why.
Yeah, I'm watching the TIFO football video that you had sent us, where it was the 07-08 tactic explained.
That's a fantastic video.
I thought it was really, really interesting, because, of course, when you watch the season review, you know, if you didn't have the same context of watching the games week in and week out, you might not be able to quite figure out, you know, the brilliance of what that team was doing. But when you see the tactics explained, I thought it was really interesting to see, you know, how Ferguson really relied on, because he knew how good individually each one of his players were. He really relied on them to just handle their business. And so there wasn't a lot of pressing that the team even did, you know, something that's so in vogue nowadays. Ferguson just knew, he's like, look, my 11's better than your 11 on any given Saturday or Sunday, and they're going to show up and do that. And so that's why you have Ferdinand, who could, if he needed to, go cover out on a wing real quick and then come right back, you know, in the central defense. And then you had his partnership with Vidic. I mean, that was just a hard team to score on. And then, you know, you had Van der Sar, who was long in the tooth at that point, but he is still a quality goalkeeper.
Yeah, what you just said, and Rooney just said the same thing in that article that he, or it was an interview, or maybe that article that he said in the Daily Times or whatever. But when he said, you know, a lot of weeks, exactly what you just said, a lot of weeks our team talk was, right, you 11 are better than their 11. Go out there and win. And when you watch the game, this is what I've been saying this all year, because I really have been working on this all year. I don't know if I'll ever end up writing it, but all the criticism that Solskjaer faces this year, because, oh, the team is all he could do is counterattack, and they can't break down low blocks, and all they can do is counterattack, and he said he was going to play like Ferguson. That was this team. All they did was counterattack. And like Nathan just said, there was no pressing. Rooney and Tevez would occasionally run and pressure the goalkeeper and pressure them, and it looked like pressing, But if you watch, nobody else is moving with them. So all they were actually doing, which we didn't, it wasn't in vogue at the time, and people didn't do this, and no one was studying it and being like, hey, this is stupid. But if you did it today, everybody would be like, all they're doing is wasting their energy. Because if you run at the goalkeeper and nobody else follows and doesn't cut off the passing lane, all he's going to do is pass it to a teammate, and you just ran for no reason. This team just sat back. They dropped back as soon as you got the ball. Occasionally, one player would you know, run at you, and those players were so good that they could steal it. But a lot of times, they just kept backing up on you because eventually they'd trap you, and they were like, also, the more that you guys come forward, the more space we'll have to get behind you. And that team did also, at times, struggle to break down low blocks. The difference between that team and this team is Cristiano Ronaldo could take a free kick and put it in, or he could shoot from 40 yards out and put it in. And if you have somebody that could do that consistently, it's a lot easier to beat a low block. And how many times did we see United, it took them 30, 35, 50, 60 minutes to get goal number one. And then as soon as goal number one came, the opposing team would be like, well, now we got to go and push on for an equalizer. And goals 2, 3, and 4 just immediately followed. You know, as soon as they devoted players forward, United were like, cool, we're going to pick you apart on the break now.
Yeah, it was beautiful to watch that team on the counterattack because, like you said, they'd sit back, they'd absorb the pressure, and then the moment that they could regain possession, that ball got pushed up to, you know, like Michael Carrick or Scholes in that double pivot on the 4-4-2, and then immediately they're splashing the ball out to the wings. And I think it's really interesting and just amazing to watch the fluidity at which the front three were able to participate then, because you had Rooney, you had Tevez, you had Ronaldo. They could all play centrally, they could all play wide, they could all drop back if they needed to. And they say it in the video, and it was what Alex Ferguson said, I believe, mentioned as well. You know, on any given day, the opposing defense had no idea what their defensive assignment was going to be because they didn't know, you know, where that front three was going to line up. So the moment you could get that ball to Carrick or Scholes, they play it out wide, and all of a sudden they're on the break, and the defense is just trying to figure out, where do we even set up so that way we can try and defend this?
Yeah, and to go on that, you know, when people, again, this is the things I've been watching all year, trying to compile GIFs and everything, which probably the funniest thing that I found about this season is I'll tweet something out and be like, I just watched this game yesterday, and here's what happened. And then someone will respond like, nah, mate, I remember it differently. And it's like, cool, I remembered it differently too. And that's why I went and rewatched this thing. And turns out, like, the footage doesn't lie. And what that TiVo video that you talked about was how they played in Europe. And people criticize Solskjaer now for all this defensive football. Ferguson was insanely defensive in Europe, which is something that he realized back in the 90s. Back when, as Colin said, we really should have won in Europe more often. But at the time, Europe was kind of dominated by the Italians. Why? Because you couldn't score on the Italians. And United used to, you know, they'd pummel teams the same way they pummeled Portsmouth. And they'd lose 1-0 and go out. And they realized eventually, you know, like, if we take 20 shots, we might score on a few of them, but we may not. And if we give up 6 or 7, you may score and we could go out. But if you don't take any shots, you won't score and we won't go out. And they became more defensive in 99. They became much more defensive in the knockout rounds of this competition. They played pretty open against Lyon, and Lyon got a 1-1 draw in the first leg, and that second leg was actually pretty tense. And after that, they switched to that 4-5-1. Rooney would play wide. Tevez basically wasn't even in the team anymore. Park would come in and cause havoc. And it was very pragmatic, a very pragmatic approach to everything. And it relied on Ronaldo doing some crazy things. And, you know, there was that game against Roma where Ferguson was like, we moved Rooney centrally for 10 minutes. He scored. And it's like, yeah, you do that just to create some little difference in the team, give them some sort of different look, and boom, that's how good they were. They'd punish you for that.
It's interesting in Europe, too, to see. Sir Alex had always, I think, since really the treble season, he'd been somebody who changed up his team a lot for European looks. I had a conversation with Paul Ansorge from No Question About That podcast, and I made a comment about Juan Seba Veyron being a kind of like weird punt buy, like a weird punt buy getting Juan Seba Veyron, and he corrected me saying that this was actually part of a calculated move to try and be more competitive in Europe and switch to a more of a 4-3-3 formation. And that's sort of what Sir Alex Ferguson did for most of the mid-2000s, mid and late-2000s, was adapt his team to look like a 4-3-3. And the TIFO video did this a little bit, too, where they talk about the way they lined up in the final, where it was, on the team sheet, it was a 4-4-2 with Rooney and Tevez up top, but the way that it ended up playing out was Rooney was much more of a right winger, Owen Hargreaves kind of playing as a white winger, right winger as well, and Tevez and Ronaldo playing more as the forward roles. And you see this happen in the Champions League final a little bit against Chelsea, but I think you see this against Barcelona as well, where it's similar to Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's tactics that we saw this past year on the counter-attacking side, that he kind of presses for a goal early on and then will sit back later in the game.
Yeah.
And maybe that's not exactly what happened in the Champions League final, because Chelsea were, you know, an immensely talented team, and they sort of took control in the second half and then lost their way a little bit in extra time. But against Barcelona especially, you see this. Paul Scholes getting that early goal in kind of his Roy Keane semi-final 99 moment of, you know, redemption and getting his team to the final. And then
Ferguson pulling him off to be like, I gotta make sure that you could play in this one.
Right. But, I mean, the second half of that game, I remember Barcelona absolutely dominating us.
And under siege. Our goal was under siege. I remember this was back in the day of ESPN doing the Champions League, and it was Derek Ray and Tommy Smith. And at one point, there was like 6 minutes of stoppage time in that game, and it must have been like the third minute of the stoppage time. United got the ball, and they were able to just hoof it all the way down the field, all the way out of play. And Tommy Smith just goes, not a ball boy in sight. And I loved it.
Yeah, I mean, there was the clip in the I'm surprised they even put it in the footage. I mean, Lionel Messi absolutely stole, I believe it was Paul Scholes, just absolutely took his soul from him as he was dribbling down the back line to put in a cross. I mean, it was one of those things where you really got that vibe where they were under siege, even just from the highlights. It did not look like it was, you know, the most comfortable win that they could have had.
Yeah, that play has been making its rounds on Twitter like the last couple of months, because it's been like memed, like, oh, look, like Messi destroying Scholes, and oh, how is Scholes this good? Like Messi just completely killed him. It's like, hey, Scholes scored from 35 yards out that game and brought his team to the final.
Also, wasn't Messi like 22?
Messi was the one marking Scholes on that card.
Yeah, marking is a really generous word.
Yeah, I mean, it was.
Messi was like 19 at the time.
Yeah, isn't there like Ronaldo, a 10 or a 12 year difference between the two as well? Like, I mean,
Ronaldo made the leap that season. Messi made it the following season.
Yeah.
But yeah, like what Colin was talking about before, that was also part of the beauty of Ferguson's team and how flexible it was you had Hargreaves, who could actually play out wide on the right. He actually started at right back in the first leg against Barcelona because Wes Brown was out hurt. So you could play him out wide on the right and let Rooney and Ronaldo and Tevez get in the middle and queue up for a cross. Or he could tuck inside and become a 4-3-3 with Ronaldo pushing up or whoever was out on the left between Rooney, Tevez, and Ronaldo, pushing up to make it a 4-3-3 and, you know, like that. The issue, and Ferguson did do that throughout the mid-2000s. He was trying to change his team up more in Europe. I think the issue was, back then, it was like, until Mourinho came around, and even when Mourinho came around, it was slow to adapt. Mourinho and Wenger, it was either you're playing a 4-4-2 or you're playing a 4-5-1, and a 4-5-1 just sounds like insanely defensive. So even when it was like Rooney and Tevez or something, or in the Van Nistelrooy days when he would play it with Rooney out wide on the left, you know, it's still more of a 4-3-3, but like when you call it a 4-5-1, it just sounds so much worse. And fans were not happy with that at all. There was a year where they were like the year before they won the title, they were revolting against Ferguson, you know, stop playing this. And they thought it was Carlos Kirosh's doing, which it probably was. And they wanted Kirosh fired. They were like, just go back to the 4-4-2. And in Europe, it was they were so good at being able to, you know, Park could tuck inside and make a three-man midfield, or Hargreaves can, you know, you could have a Fletcher, a Scholes, Carrick, Hargreaves midfield with Rooney, Ronaldo, Tevez up top, or like they did in the final, you know, or Hargreaves can just drift out wide to create a 4-4-2. And that makes you really, it's like what I've written about the back three for Solskjaer right now. The fact that Luke Shaw can make underlapping runs forward and Brandon Williams could just drop back. If Shaw gets caught up, Brandon Williams can drop back and they could fall into a 4-2-3-1 until they have time to reset. It makes it hard for the defense to know what's going to come.
Yep, and then at the end of the day, you have Cristiano Ronaldo, who was just banging in goal after goal. Like, I mean, it's just unbelievable. I had said that in our little group chat, too, as we prepared for this. It was just like, you know, I've gotten to see the latter stages of Ronaldo. I didn't get to watch him at United live. You know, I've seen him at Real Madrid. I've seen him at Juventus. And, I mean, he's a cheat code now, but, I mean, the talent that he had and was able to just like score on a whim, it seemed like, for United. It was just unbelievable watching him in the highlights.
Yeah, still not my favorite Ronaldo, though. I forever hold dear like the early years of Ronaldo when he was doing too many stepovers and he was just making defenders look just absolutely stupid, but had no end product. And, you know, he'd dance around four or five defenders, and then the sixth one would finally knock him off the ball. And it was
like Nani?
Yeah, but like way better than Nani.
Yeah.
That was my favorite Ronaldo. But another area that like people forget about this season was how close it. We mentioned this earlier, how it came down on the final day on Chelsea, but United almost threw this title away. Yeah. I think they won 3 out of 6 of their last games. And Ferguson kind of realized, hey, this free-running team that I've had all season that's been scoring for fun, kind of tired. They're leaving themselves open. It's not working. And he kind of went down the stretch, even in England, to the Europe style that he was playing, where they sat back much more. They defended more as a unit. They got forward when they could. And, you know, it's like the it's like most teams in the World Cup. It's like, hey, let's sit back, let's defend tight, let's get forward, and let's rely on a set piece or two to do it. You know, how many games down the stretch did they win because of a Ronaldo penalty or beating Arsenal because of the Owen Hargreaves free kick? All these games, I think their two goals in that game was a Ronaldo penalty and the Hargreaves free kick. All these games, United, it wasn't as intense as the Barcelona game. You know, it wasn't as great of a siege as the Barcelona tie. But for a lot of them, United were outpossessed and outshot in all these, and they were just sitting back and absorbing the pressure because that was they at that point, it was more we need to win these games and not so much, hey, we need to score 8,000 goals.
Yeah, I think it was if they had won the Blackburn game, then they could have won the title at Stamford Bridge the next week. Yep. But everything kind of went wrong in that Chelsea game because not only were they able to, you know, get level with us on points again after that, but Rooney also got injured after scoring the equalizer.
Oh, got injured in April? Tell me, like, you know, how many times did that happen?
We don't need to talk about that, Paul.
I'm just saying, like, it just, I forgot about that, so, like, when you say it, I'm like, yeah, well, checks out. Like, the only thing was England didn't qualify for the Euros that year, but major tournament that summer, a.k.a. Rooney gets hurt in April.
Yeah, there we go. But yeah, I mean, and this was a Premier League season too, where they didn't lead for most of it, I think, until maybe February, because Arsenal got out to a pretty big lead early on when United started the season poorly, and then
started the season awful. 2 points in our first three games.
Yeah, and with two losses to Manchester City that season before they even had a squad that could contend with us.
It was Ben Johnny with a brace in the Old Trafford fixture. But yeah, they opened up by not scoring against Reading, drawing against Portsmouth, which is the game where Ronaldo got sent off, mm-hmm. and then losing to City. And, you know, we were 17th when we faced Spurs.
Yeah. But I think we went on a run of 1-0 games and then a couple 4-0 FC games.
Juggled first and second place all the way until March, and that's when we never relinquished first after that point. But yeah, I mean, the points and the were really, really tight that whole season.
Yeah, that we juggled, we did. We went on a run of, we had three straight 1-0s, then we beat Chelsea 2-0, and then another 1-0 win, and it was this. I was trying to explain this to Nathan at the time. There was a lot of talk about, will this team click? Are Rooney and Tevez too similar to each other that they can't be on the field at the same time? And maybe you need to play Luis Saha with one or the other. A lot of talk about that. Like, luckily the defense, I mean, this is basically what our season is this year, except last in 2008, teams weren't getting freak Ruben Neves goals to get a late equalizer. They were just holding on to win 1-0. And then Wigan came to town, and Wigan, I feel like every time we struggle defensively or something, Wigan comes to town and we beat them 4-0, and it solves all of our problems. And Wigan came to town, it solved our problems, and 2 weeks later we had that Rooney, Tevez to Rooney, back to Tevez goal, which is one of my favorite goals the team has ever scored. And last night I was trying to explain this to Nathan, like, you don't understand how big that goal was because of the fact that for weeks it was, can Rooney and Tevez play together? And then they hit that goal, and no one ever asked that question again.
And it was even before that in the summer, I think, that it was just like, they're too similar, this isn't going to work. And why wouldn't you want your two strikers to be hardworking ball winners? Like,
they were both, you know, if we remember the time, you know, it was Mourinho did his Mourinho thing. Wenger had how Arsenal was playing, although they had just lost Henry that year. Yeah, they had just lost Henry that year because I bought one of those blue Thierry Henry Barcelona kits because I loved that Barcelona kit and had to rub it into the Arsenal fans' faces that Henry was playing for them. So who knows? Everybody else, it was basically 4-4-2, big striker, little striker. Like, you know, big target man, and your little quick striker that likes to play off the shoulder of the, you know, just in behind, drop into the space, but also run into the channels and get those through balls. You know, you get it to your target man, and he flicks it on, your little striker runs. And Rooney and Tevez were both that guy. And so everybody was kind of like, well, how can you have a team now that doesn't have the center forward? You just have two guys that like to play behind the center forward. You know, it's only now that we look back on it and we're like, yeah, Kiarosh was working his magic here to be like, no, this team isn't going to have a center forward. They're going to have three guys up front that are going to just switch and interchange and drive you nuts. And it took them a little bit of time to get that going. And Ronaldo picking up that red card in the second game of the year and missing the City, Spurs, and Sunderland matches, that definitely didn't help.
Yeah, Rooney also got hurt, I think, against either Portsmouth or Reading.
Yeah, I think he missed the beginning of the season too.
Yeah.
So yeah, and that was like back at the time of Rooney's career where he used to, like, I feel like he had a couple of years where he'd start the season slow, and then September, October, he'd just start hammering in goals for club and country, and then get hurt again.
Yeah, that's kind of Rooney's whole career, really. He just scores in bunches and gets hurt a lot.
All right. Hey, if you got a thing, you can't knock it, right?
Yeah, I mean, it worked for him at the time, so.
Yeah, and I had mentioned, too, one of the kind of the curiosities as I was doing some research about this season and then, you know, subsequent seasons. Ronaldo scores 31 goals in the Premier League that season. I believe his goal tally was over 40 for the campaign, right?
42.
Yeah, so, and then I thought it was interesting, so he gets 31, and then the next season, Anelka wins the Golden Boot with 19. And I thought it was interesting how in that next year I don't know if it was a drop-off in just having one big-time scorer or if it was just an offensive drop-off in general in the league that year.
It was Dimitar Berbatov. Colin just said, or I think he said this in the Slack, this is a season that stands out again because, like, when you look at this team, Giggs and Scholes were old, but they played another, 7 years after this? So they weren't old yet. This is a team that should have won a lot more. I mean, I remember the 2009 Champions League kind of not being an exciting run because it was, no, this team's got, like, the year before.
Yeah, we were supposed to do that at that point.
Right.
You know?
In 2007, we kind of went further than we should have, and we lost in the second leg of the semifinal to AC Milan. So this year it was like, we have to take the next step. And then the next year it was just, no, we should walk right through this. And the best, that 2009 final, the best comparison to it would be the 2001 Super Bowl, the first Tom Brady Super Bowl against the Rams, where the Rams entered as 14-point favorites. You know, who are these Patriots? Who's this Tom Brady rookie quarterback? And the Patriots just, they beat them and go on to be this dynasty. United were the Rams. Everybody thought United were going to walk over Barcelona that year. And they should have won more. To me, it always comes back to just completely uselessly signing Dimitar Berbatov because they wanted him, I guess. Like, it was just a novelty, and he was great. He was fun to watch, but he just didn't fit into the team at all. And you had to play a different style when he was on the pitch, and I think that ruined a lot of the cohesiveness.
That Super Bowl is a really good comp for that final, but I'm going to adjust it a little bit. It would have been like that if that 2001 Patriots team had the 2007 Patriots offense, because this Barcelona team was scoring, like, left and right.
Yeah.
They did have Messi and Henri on that team.
Stefano and...
There's a Barca documentary, I think it's on either Netflix or Amazon, where Guardiola just says, like, yeah, I thought Messi's our best player, I'm going to put him in the middle. So, like, yeah, that seemed, that makes sense.
And, like, reinvent
the
nine position.
Yeah.
And he did that for, like, 2 years, and then he put him back on the right again.
Yeah, that worked out pretty well, too.
Yeah, well, but, like, he did it for, like, the 2 years, and, like, Messi scored 60 goals in one of those years.
Yeah.
This is another thing that, like, came up recently, as I said, like, oh, yeah, Messi, like, reinvented the false nine position, and Pierre, like, nah, he was always, like, a right winger, and it was like, okay, but, like, there were two seasons where he was, and they're like, nah, I remember him playing, like, off on the right, and I'm like, cool, that's what you remember, go back, watch the tapes.
I mean, it's kind of crazy they didn't win the Champions League again the next season, or the season between their two Champions Leagues, the 2009-2010. Although they did have that bus ride to Milan. So.
Yeah, you think, like, that's what everybody, like, remembers. Hey, Mourinho, like, beat Barcelona, and he did, you beat them after they came off a bus for 16 hours, and then the next week they beat you 1-0. Mourinho's Champions League career has a lot of very big breaks in it, which I guess everybody needs, but his had two very big ones.
Yeah, I was going to say, Sir Alex Ferguson's two Champions League comes from a penalty shootout and two goals in stoppage time. So,
right, no, I mean
it's not a walk in the park for anyone.
Right, you need to be lucky and good, or you need to be good and lucky. Every championship team has their run of luck along the way, but, like, hey, Barcelona having to take a 16-hour bus ride and Tim Howard just parrying the ball right to your striker and being like, hey, kick this into the net with no time left. Those are some pretty big breaks.
Yeah. All right. To wrap this up, do you guys have a favorite goal from this season? I know I didn't put this in the Slack beforehand, but I have one picked out.
I already said mine. It was that.
The Tevez Ronaldo.
Anderson to Tevez Rooney. Yeah. Rooney to Tevez. Goal against Middlesbrough. Honorable mention will be Ronaldo's back heel against Aston Villa off the corner.
My pick for favorite goal is actually that same game, Ronaldo's back heel through ball to Rooney, which I choose to be intentional and not a total accident of an assist.
I mean, that game was one of the most fun games to ever watch.
Yeah.
I've got two written down when I was just, like, live tweeting to just you two my reactions as I watched it. I gotta say, I'm still, like, in love with that screamer from Nani against Middlesbrough. The one that probably helped build up the hype that Paulie's always talking about for Nani. And
now
then,
you know why he tried to do it every time.
Hey, bangers only, man. I'm into it. And then Ronaldo's free kick against Portsmouth is just, I mean, that's just otherworldly. I mean, when you watch that thing in slow motion and you realize that that ball does not spin as it bends and dips, it's unbelievable.
There might not be another free kick that I have tried to emulate as much as that one, where I just like was like, okay, and I went outside that day and just kept hitting a ball.
And you're like, wait, but every time I do it, it spins. I don't yeah. get it.
Yeah.
I did start like futzing around and trying to stand over the ball the way Ronaldo did for his free, and I was like, yeah, no, this is never gonna work. and that's why I moved to become a goalie.
All right, guys.
Oh, also, underappreciated performance from that season. America's own Brad Friedel in goal against Manchester United.
Brad Friedel always had a good game at Old Trafford, or against Manchester United. That was a trend that he kept up, I think, for a couple more years, too. But yeah, even, like, the early 2000s.
If I were him, I would just introduce myself at every party, be like, hey, I'm Brad Friedel. I stonewalled Cristiano Ronaldo's shot one time.
Dude, it's weird if you read Tim Howard's book when he talks about like team players he's like played against, and he's like, yeah, like I know two guys that used to like be eccentric like this. One was Phil Jagielka, and you'll be like, yeah, that's normal. The other one's Ronaldo, and I'm like, oh right, you guys were teammates. Like, you completely forget about that. But Brad Friedel is like top of the list of players who I have forgotten about every one of their good contributions on the field because they just became such terrible media members.
You're not also putting Taylor Twellman in there, are you?
No, I like Taylor Twellman. Okay. I like him. I am pretty lukewarm on Stu Holden. But Brad Friedel, just that one Gold Cup where he spent the entire time yelling into the microphone was just awful. And he also was kind of a douche. He tried to block Tim Howard's move to United. He would not sign off on him getting a visa, which is something that you oddly needed, and tried to play it off like, oh, I was doing it to help Tim Howard. And it's like, no, you weren't. You're just kind of a douche.
I would like to push back just a smidge. You know, it's a big MLS game when it's John Strong and Stu Holden on the mic.
Yeah,
like he's not bad.
And I am totally fine. I like Stu Holden. I'm totally fine with them doing MLS games. I didn't like it when they did Champions League games.
Oh, that was the worst. And,
yeah, and I didn't like them being the top pair for the World Cup. Like,
well, do you prefer Stu or Alexi?
I prefer Stu. I think Stu's good. I think it's just, you know, the way that Fox makes you become kind of a hot take head, because I thought Alexi was brilliant at ESPN. I thought, like, the studio crew of Bob Lee and
well, Bob Lee's different class.
I mean, and Steve McManaman and Alexi Lalas for the 2014 World Cup, and like, and even the Euros in 2012 with Mikael Ball. Like, those guys, you could tell like they genuinely loved each other and they were really good. And they would rein in Lalas. He was pretty talky heady after the before the 2014 World Cup, and he like said to the U.S. men's national team's face in Times Square, he was like, I'm picking Germany and Ghana to go through, or Germany and Portugal to go through. And he was like, prove me wrong. But I thought that they were brilliant. It's when he moved to Fox. And like, I think if Stu Holden didn't have to be at Fox and like have this hot take centric personality, he'd be much better.
Yeah, I'd say that's fair.
See, I think Fox used to have really, really good coverage, though, back when it was like Fox Soccer Channel.
When nobody watched, and like they did not, and like they just took the when they just took the world feed, it was great.
Yeah,
you had that random dial tone in the middle, and then you went back to like Nick Webster and Warren Barton sitting in like a closet with a TV from 2001 in there.
Well, that's where they do all their Bundesliga pregames now, I think, is in that
but
same
closet. But the closet's,
closet.
Like, more decorated.
Yeah, they put beer steins in there.
Exactly, if it's the same studio.
Yeah.
Yeah.
God, right. I miss soccer.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
But, hey, Nathan, did you pick up FIFA on PS4?
No, it's on my to-do list. I've got to continue practicing Rocket League, but once that tournament's over, I'll pick it up.
Wait, you don't have FIFA on PS4? What have you been playing?
I've got it on Xbox One, baby.
Oh, so
the lesser of the consoles.
Which, by the way, I'm gonna put some pressure on myself and say this publicly, so that way I do it.
You have a PS4 and an Xbox One?
Yeah, man.
Jesus.
I used to work at Best Buy. I had extra spending money. No, but what I'm going to do is, listeners, for all you FIFA heads out there, I have the Bruno Fernandes Player of the Month card. It is incredible. I will be writing about it. Do the squad builders.
Top content.
Well, if you didn't know this, while we were recording, our challenge preview was...
Hell yeah, it did.
Oh, yeah, go check that out. I have no idea what the challenge is or what is on MTV anymore. But
let me tell you, it's better than music. Power Rangers.
It's not music that's on MTV.
is there bowling for soup?
Nathan and I worked and compared every challenge member to a Manchester United player or former Manchester United player or Manchester United rival.
I'm really proud of some of the ones that we came up with. I think they're really good. If you don't have the context of the challenge, you might struggle just a little bit with it, but I think we still did a pretty good job of explaining some of them. I think my favorite one is TJ Lavin to Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, the host of the challenge.
It's the easiest one.
Yeah, I mean, but they really are kind of alike. They're Mr. Positives, but they just don't want to see the people under them, you know, slack off. They're like, look, if you're going to be here, you're going to be here and you're going to do it right. Don't quit on me.
We took Corey and made him Jesse Lingard. And then 2 days ago, Nathan and I were like talking about the challenge and he started talking about Corey and literally just described Lingard. It was like hilarious.
Messy Corey.
All right. So, yep. Check out that. And, I think that'll maybe inspire me to get back to work on my Naruto Manchester United player comps. So far, I've got Pogba as Sasuke because he's trying to leave.
See, now, finally, something I don't understand anything about.
Yeah, there we go.
All right, youths and your animes.
Well, thanks
also,
for tuning in.
I didn't get enough credit. I thought my Leroy, when he has to face the top four, always falters line, comparing him to Lukaku, like, great line.
Polly from the challenge and Mino Rail is probably the second best shout. But in other non-sports related news too, be on the lookout this weekend for my recap of episode 2 of the newest season of Top Chef. If you can't handle the fire, get out of the kitchen.
Oh yeah, we keep the content rolling at the Busby Babe, whether there are sports or not.
Virus be damned.
Virus be damned. Yep. Well, thanks for tuning in again. We will likely not have sports for a long time, so expect episodes similar to this where we talk about past Manchester United achievements, which is probably, watching these is a bit more fun than watching the current Manchester United team. Actually, I take
that
back.
Well, not over the last 5 weeks, Manchester United team. They're fun.
On the winning run. Yeah, that has been fun. But if
I were to make a suggestion, I think we should do the Europa League season pretty soon.
16-17?
Yeah.
I do have that season review on DVD. I can find
it. Did you see the link I sent you this morning?
Yeah,
I found the
Daily Motion also has a bunch of them.
Yeah, and Daily Motion's like good quality.
Yeah.
So
actually, I think 16-17 might be on Daily Motion as well. So
I'm going to fire up 12-13 this afternoon, probably right before the fiance gets home. And when she walks in, I'll be like, oh, hey, yeah, I'm just watching this. You know,
I can't wait to watch some Mkhitaryan goals again.
He is a player that I forget played for us sometimes. And it's only been 2 years.
I can't forget him. I thought he scored big goals in the Europa League. He was really, really important for us.
But so was Ighalo.
Yeah, I mean, he was pivotal in us getting Champions League the next year, which I think was...
This is the conversation we should wait until we actually discuss.
Yes.
Either the managers or that season.
All right, we won't say any more. We'll keep it for the next time.
Right. All right. Well, I've been Colin.
I'm Nathan.
Paulie.
We'll see you guys next time.